Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Metropolitan Ave. I'm your host for the next 40 minutes, DJ Lady DM. If you're tuning in for the first time, Metropolitan Ave brings you the best independent musical talent, most of whom are discovered performing in non-traditional venues here in New York City. If you miss our live broadcast, you'll find us archived on the heritageradionetwork.org website. And for those of you on the go, pick us up as a podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Tonight's in-studio guest is Emily White, co-founder of Whitesmith Entertainment and Ready Made Records. Emily originally joined us via phone on October 8th during our show with Streets of Laredo. We're happy to announce that she's joined the Metropolitan Avenue team. And tonight we'll be introducing Emily to our listening audience with an in-depth interview. So hi, Emily. Welcome to Metropolitan Ave.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to finally have you down to the studio. I know you were on the phone last time, so you didn't get a chance to see the whole atmosphere here. What do you think?
It's great. I love it.
Last month, when you were on the show, we spoke about CMJ. We covered networking. We also touched on your label and the management company. I'd like to speak a bit more tonight about your start in the industry and your experiences specifically as like a day-to-day manager. I don't think many artists ever get a chance to hear the perspective of the people handling them, you know, and what they go through to make things happen. So anywhere that you'd like to start?
Sure. I started as an intern in Boston. I really started by interning for the Dresden Dolls and eventually became their merch person, tour manager, day-to-day manager, and manager. And day-to-day management is something ultimately I still do, even though I'm a manager and executive, because it's really the foundation of our artists' careers. And what it really entails is just being organized at all times. You know, the manager sets the short and long-term plan, and we're always overseeing the team around the artist to make sure that plan is coming together and all the dots are connected. So I really rely on my day-to-day managers to make sure interviews are getting scheduled, gear is where it needs to be, we're responding to publicists, agents, we're approving, having the artists approve who's opening for them. Really every detail that goes into being a band and the business around the band, I rely on my day-to-day managers for. It's something that, you know, I'm really involved in every decision, but it's really important that we respond to everyone, whether it's a photographer, a promoter, things like that. And we try to keep things really consolidated and organized for our artists. So we'll send them maybe one email a day that's very clear and bullet pointed. You know, here's everything that came in. Here's what we need approvals on. Here are next steps. And most of our artists are pretty good at communication, but should they miss that email, I really rely on our day-to-day managers to make sure nothing slips through the cracks, because I'm always working on making the next opportunity happen. And in the meantime, there's a really wonderful girl, Melissa Garcia, that helps me out. And she is constantly making sure that the artist approves everything and that we really stay on track.
Great. I want to talk a little bit about the hierarchy in some management companies, because there's day-to-day managers and then there's managers that deal with something else. And also want to get specific. What do you mean by a team?
Sure. Well, the team around an artist can entail, I mean, ideally, a booking agent, a publicist, a radio person, that can be part of a label, a business manager, an attorney. So you have all these people, and that's great, but you need to make sure that they are working together cohesively for the greater good of the artist, and also, frankly, that they're paying attention. And it's not anything against them, but, you know, people get really busy, they tend to take on too much. So kind of, as the manager, I'm the CEO of the band, and I really need to make sure that everybody is working as hard as possible for the band, which is ultimately their company.
And how do you nurture those relationships?
I think nurture is a great word. You know, I think it's really being accountable and doing the things that I say I'm going to do and going to a lot of concerts and following up and just having a good professional relationship reputation rather in general is really the key to those relationships. It also means, you know, whenever I take on an artist, whether they're completely brand new or totally established, they're generally happy to hear I'm on board. You know, like if there's anything I'm proud of, it's my reputation in the music industry. And I think ultimately I'm known for getting back to people, you know, and being proactive. And that sounds so basic, but there are a lot of flaky people. So the more accountable you can be in your career, the more people are going to want to work with you.
So say I'm an independent artist, I'm approached by a management company. I know there's many different types of management companies and again, hierarchies. Can you explain kind of what's out there?
Sure. I'd say, you know, Whitesmith Entertainment's kind of in between. You know, there's definitely solo managers. I guess I'm kind of that, but I'm certainly part of a company. So, you could start with a friendager, you know, so someone who's really enthusiastic and excited about your music and the business and hopefully is excited about the music industry and not just being kind of like a hanger-oner. Because if people think this is just about being cool and hanging out, that's really 5 to 10% of it. It's it's really being a geek about the work and your inbox and being really organized and on top of things. So, you know, we're kind of in between. We're a boutique management firm. Ultimately, I'm still going to be copied on every email and making all the major decisions. But we have day-to-day managers helping out on each band to even accompany them to promo things and just, you know, make sure nothing is slipping through the cracks. And then there's bigger management firms like Red Light and Vector, and that's great too. And a lot of the day-to-day managers are kind of your point manager there. So it's really, you know, it depends on what you want. We've had people come from those bigger management firms and work with us, which is great because they were looking for someone to be a little more hands-on. And I know, you know, for a guy like Brennan Benson that's actually been with Vector and Red Light, I think he was happy to have the partner answer the phone, you know, and have me be really accountable for his career. So, you know, if you're in that position where you have a choice, it's up to you. I think something I'm really proud of as a manager is, you know, I'm constantly thinking about the long term of my artist's career. And I know that that ultimately should be a manager's job. But I do know larger management firms that have dropped artists because they didn't hear a single or whatever. And frankly, I could care less if there's a single, you know, because that's such a rare, you know, a hit song is such a rare thing. So I'm thinking about building the foundation of an artist's career and their fan base and making it really sustainable because that's what's going to make it long term. Not necessarily a hit or not. A hit is great, but a lot of times those fair weather fans go away when that happens. So taking care of your core fan base is really the foundation of what we do.
Can you tell us a little bit about your story and your journey through where you started? And I also wanted to briefly mention some management companies have a day-to-day manager, then they'll have a manager that's just in charge of the bigger deals and licensing and sync. And you can tell us a little bit about that. And
sure, yeah. So I'm from Wisconsin originally, so I knew no one in the entertainment industry. And I went to Northeastern University in Boston because they had a great music business program that alternated semesters going to school and interning. And the thought of interning in the music industry was like the most exciting thing ever to me. So I did about 8 internships as an undergrad. The first one was at Powderfinger Promotions, which was college indie radio promo and PR. And I was really nervous. And I remember the woman that interviewed me, and she seemed so cool and gave me all these free CDs at the time. And now, you know, 10 years later, she's actually one of my best friends. She's only a couple years older than me. And apparently, you know, she would tell me, her name's Winifred Chain, that I was the best intern they ever had, which I thought was really sad because all I did was what they asked me to do. And I said yes to going to every show. And, you know, I think that's something really important that people need to keep in mind, that if they're being invited to things, even if it's a genre they're not super into, you're going to be meeting all these key people and just taking in the experience of how it works. So, you know, that was my first internship. After that, one thing I promised myself was to never intern at the same place twice. So even though I had a great experience interning for Winifred at Powderfinger, I wanted to expand my horizons a little bit and make sure I got as much variety as possible in the music industry. So I interned at a place called Q Division after that, which is a great recording studio and indie label in Boston. And simultaneously, I was interning at WBCN in Boston, which was a big alternative radio station. And sadly, it's not there anymore, but they were like the first to play The Police in America in 1982 and pretty legendary. And so when I was at WBCN, we would have Coldplay in the studio, all these amazing things. Everybody really liked me. And at Q Division, it seemed like everything I did was wrong. And the head of the label just wasn't into me. So I really questioned, you know, should I just spend all my time at BCN? What should I do? Is this a waste of time? And one day, one of the guys in one of the bands on the label came in and asked my help on a press kit. And he was happy with my work. And I always wanted to get into touring and concert production. So he said, hey, can you sell merch for my band at the Paradise this weekend? We're opening for Kay Hanley. And this was like a dream come true. And he paid me $50. And his name's Ed Velasquez. And he has turned out to be one of my best mentors and really taught me how to tour manage and things like that. So my point is, even if you're in an internship or a situation that doesn't seem great at the time, you might not realize the things that you get out of it. So after that, I interned at, I mean, basically what's Live Nation Boston now, because I loved shows. And I got a job doing guest lists and ticket ripping at a couple of great clubs in Boston. And the summer after that, I interned at VH1 Classic in New York when I was 19 or 20 or so. And that was great to come to New York. And I met the Dresden Dolls that fall. I just approached them at a show. They were doing well locally. And I figured they had help. But I approached Amanda Palmer at a show and just said, hey, I'm a music business major and I write for this magazine and do these other things. And let me know if you ever need help with anything. And she said, can you come over tomorrow? She was really overwhelmed and had sold like 10,000 records out of her bedroom and was basically running her own label and doing their PR and booking and things like that. So they had had offers of help before, but they were kind of from fans. And I was a fan, but was taking it seriously as a career. So my point is, you know, you don't want to be obnoxious, but it never hurts to ask. And that really set the trajectory for my career. I did an internship in London at MTV that I got through my VH1 New York internship, but eventually came back and worked for the Dolls and went on their first quote-unquote national tour where they were playing South by Southwest, which was great.
How did you make that jump to tour management? And tell us a little bit about what that's like.
Sure, yeah. So I knew I didn't want to tour manage forever, but I wanted to do it. And I love to travel and I love shows. And so I asked Amanda one day, I said, so you're going on this national tour, which is going to South By, and that's great. But they're also playing barbecues and a sports bar. And I said, who's going to tour manage? And she said, oh, I was just going to do it. And I didn't know her very well. And I said, well, I'd love to try it. I'm on what's called co-op interning that semester. And I don't know what I'm doing, but I could at least sell your merch. And she was very serious. She said, this is a band decision. We need to ask Brian. There's only one other person in the band. So I waited a week, you know, tell my friends I might be going to South By. And so a week later, I'm like, hey, so did you get a chance to talk to Brian? And she's like, oh, I totally forgot. And yelled across the apartment and said, hey, Brian, can Emily be our tour manager? And he's like, yeah, that's cool. She's nice. And that was it. And I literally didn't know what I was doing, but I immediately emailed Ed Velasquez from the label, who had basically tour managed his band. And I probably still have this email to this day. He sent me all the questions that it takes to advance a show. And, you know,
what do you mean by advance a show?
So advance a show means reaching out to a venue or promoter. Ideally, 2 weeks before is when you want the information. So I usually reach out 3 because concert production people are busy and it's a late night job. And you ask any number of questions, you know, what time are doors? What time do you want us to load in? Is there a curfew? Because you need to be mindful of how long the band is playing. You know, here's our hospitality rider. How many guest list spots do we get? Do you have Wi-Fi? Do you have laundry? You know, just all the questions you could ever need to know while on the road. So Ed taught me how to do that and went on that first tour with the Dresden Dolls and really learned from there. I feel really lucky that we all grew up together professionally. And by the time I graduated college, I graduated, but I didn't walk in my commencement ceremony because I was at Coachella starting a multi-continent tour where the Dresden Dolls were opening for Nine Inch Nails. And I was 22 by then, and the band had management. It was a great company called Madison House. And Mike Luba, who was the band's manager, just threw me at the wolves and said, you're going to tour manage this tour? And I was absolutely in tears the first week on the bus when business managers were asking me for spreadsheets and all these things. And we didn't have hotels booked and it was crazy. But by the end of that 6 weeks, I was definitely a professional tour manager.
And how often did you actually get to sleep?
Not that often, but I did it from age 20 to 23, so it was really...
You didn't need much sleep back
then.
Yeah,
it was the perfect time. It was awesome.
That's a great story, and it's great that it's your life experience has really paid off for you. You've really established yourself in the industry as someone who's very knowledgeable about direct-to-fan strategies and business models. How did that come up? I guess just from your pedigree and the people you've worked with and their reputation, I can see how this...
Exactly. It came together really organically. You know, now I'm lucky to speak all over the world on direct-to-fan. And
you just got back from a little busy week.
Yeah, I spoke at the Grammy Future Now conference in Miami. That was fantastic. I felt like there were a lot of young musicians there.
What was the name of the panel?
I think it was like Making Sense of the DIY Era or something like that. And the following Monday, I spoke at DC Future Music, which was a similar panel. That one got the audience got a little aggressive about Spotify and streaming royalties and things like that. And that'll be a whole nother show. But, you know, direct to fan. I mean, I hosted the direct to fan camp at Meetem, which is this great conference in the south of France. So it's a thing and I write about it. But I got into it very organically because between Dresden Dolls and Amanda literally always writing the text to her email blasts, thinking, you know, she would say to me, what if you go away? What if the fancy booking agent goes, what if all these fancy people go away? This is my only line to communicate to my audience. And so we always had a really deep and natural understanding of the internet, and we always did things that made sense. And simultaneously, the Dolls had gone with Madison House for management, which is ultimately a jam band management company, which means bands like the String Cheese Incident were hosting their own festivals and they had their own label. And Mike Luba, my boss, successfully sued Ticketmaster so String Cheese could sell their own tickets directly to their fans. And they had their own merch company and PR firm and travel agent. So that was all in the early 2000s. And that's who I learned around, you know, like build a business around the artists and take care of the fans. Don't worry about, you know, even getting signed or kind of all these other things. And so between Dresden Dolls and Madison House, that's what set, you know, I think my mindset for my career. And I feel really lucky that I was able to work with such art and music loving people that do it for the right reasons.
You could give a short definition of direct to fan. What does that mean to you, literally?
All it means is, I mean, this is gonna be a little longer than short, but back in the day, you know, you'd read in a magazine about your favorite band and drive in your car and go buy a plastic CD and, you know, have to put gas in the car. There's all these steps on top of the fact that the band had to record for a label and distribute and all these things. Now I can just email you and say, what kind of music, what's a band that you like?
Wow, I just went completely blank. I'm a DJ and I generally play like tracks by people. I like Bernhoft. I'm going to go. I did merch for them recently at Bowery Ballroom, and I emailed the tour manager, mm-hmm. and now I'm going to go see their show on their guest list in awesome. 2 weeks. So he's cool. Really awesome.
So you're a fan.
Yes.
So that would just be the artist or the management team or even the label emailing and say, here's our new song. We're really excited about it. Or here's our new album, and you can buy it for $9 digitally or $100 and we'll come to your house and all these things. So all it is just taking out the middle person, man, people, whatever, and just communicating directly to the audience.
Yeah, we'll come to your house. That's definitely a more Amanda Palmer approach to you.
Right.
she's revolutionary because she made her music very, not just approachable and accessible, but she made herself as an artist extremely.
Yeah, and that's not for everyone, you know. I manage Brendan Benson and he just likes hanging out at his house with his kids and that's it, and he doesn't really understand the internet and he leaves that to us. But what we've done is made really compelling packages for the artists or for the fans and make sure we're answering every question online and really disseminating the information. So when I started managing Brendan, I had fans come up to me at shows and personally thank me and say, I've been a Brendan fan for a decade and nobody's ever sent us an email blast with tour dates or his new album info and things like that. Mm. And I'll nudge him too. You know, I called him last week and said, I have to assume you're a Lou Reed fan. Do you want to say anything about his passing? Mm. And he did. And it got a huge response online, because one thing we do is we would never pose as the artist. So if we're posting new tour dates, we tag it all as Team BB. Mm-hmm. But when he, you know, the words are his about someone like Lou Reed, that's really powerful to the fans, because they know it's actually Brendan.
And before we go to break, can you give a little word of advice or a nudge to those artists that are like your artist, Brendan, who are more introverted? They're really, you know, hands off about the business side.
Yeah. Two things. Care about your fans, you know, even if it makes you uncomfortable and feels weird, you know, like those little elements are going to make a big difference. And simultaneously get some enthusiastic friend or fan with a big mouth like me, you know, that's going to want to be your microphone and mouthpiece and spread the word. And maybe the two of you together can figure out a strategy.
That's awesome. Thanks, Emily. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with our in-studio guest, Emily White of Whitesmith Entertainment and Ready Made Records. We'll also be taking live calls at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128 for the last minutes of our broadcast. If you have questions for our guests, dial in. The number again is 718-497-2128. You can also email us your questions at info@heritageradionetwork.org.
This special program is brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation in their expertise in technology, sales, and service. Visit them on the web at techserve.com or in New York City at 119 West 23rd Street. Learn more about their in-store classes and incredible insider program. Make stuff happen. TechServe.
Welcome back to Metropolitan Ave. I'm your host, DJ Lady DM. Thanks for keeping your digital dial tuned to Brooklyn. For those of you who might be just tuning in, we're speaking with Emily White of Whitesmith Entertainment and Ready Made Records. I want to talk to you about this shifting paradigm in the music industry right now. You're a very big part of that, just by your writing and your speaking. What are some of the older concepts or ways of doing business in the record industry that you feel you're constantly trying to present alternative models for?
Sure. The manager's job kind of back in the day was always to get deals and put deals in place. And the reason you had to do that, which I was kind of alluding to, is labels controlled recording and distribution. I mean, anybody could record, but it was really expensive to set up a studio. So you needed to sign with a label to make a record when music was still a tangible good. And then the label would distribute that music worldwide. And so to me, what sums up the modern music industry is that you can record in your bedroom, you can make world-class recordings on your own, and you can distribute your music worldwide for $40, $50 using TuneCore and be on every iTunes and Amazon, Spotify, RDO worldwide. So that's completely leveled the playing field. It's also made it incredibly competitive, which is fine because the best art should win, you know? And in the past, artists really had to rely on these gatekeepers, and now they can do whatever they want, which I think is really liberating to a lot of artists. Like, I had a call with Matt Friedberger from the Fiery Furnaces last week, who I actually hadn't spoken to in a couple of years, and he said, I've been living in Paris with my girlfriend, and I have, like, three albums ready to go. I mean, he's perfect for the new music business, whether he realizes it or not. Where Brendan Benson might be like, I just want to make a record. And what I did for Brendan this year, for a couple reasons, was I had him release a song a month. Because, again, I was kind of so sick of... I love albums, of course, but as far as the industry goes and press and things like that, I was sick of just putting out an album and, you know, hoping that there's a life cycle and things like that. So I really wanted to extend that life cycle. So we released a song a month, which means we got press every month, and the radio people got a song every month, and the music supervisors and sync people got a song every month, and there were things to post on his social networks. And he was funny about it. He was just interviewed, and like I said, you know, said, oh, why can't we just make albums? So I did what Emily said, and it ended up working out. She got what she wanted, and it's not about what I want, but he understood at the end of the day what I was trying to do.
Yeah, you have a great quote on the an article that you wrote, which is on the Medium blog. Did I pronounce that right? Mm-hmm. And you said, setting up a record is a term of the past. And although it's still relevant, as I'm all about well-thought-out plans and strategies, true success will be found by connecting the fans and delivering content consistently, not just in the lead-up to an album release, if that is the format you're releasing music in. I love that.
Cool.
It's like getting away from this idea that you have to work on an album and go through this entire like big build up where you're a DIY artist, you're doing things on a tiny budget, you're stressing yourself out, you're building your hopes up and squeezing things, you know, out that possibly you don't have the supporter team or dollars in place to really like have a big bang, you know. And so you're proposing this completely alternative model to putting things out.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think of it that way, that I'm coming up with this whole new model or whatever. I'm just trying to do things that make sense. And so it used to break my heart when we would, when I was a day-to-day manager and we would have a meeting with a band and their publicist and their label would be there. And I knew how weird the music was, even though I loved it. And I would think like, this isn't going to be a hit. You know, like we need to think about the fans being excited about this music and them spreading the word. And again, I think that comes from, I mean, I'm not particularly into jam bands, but I worked at a jam band company, and none of those bands ever have hit songs or singles or things like that.
What do you mean
by
jam band?
I mean, historically, that, you know, that's like the Grateful Dead, and now that's Fish and all the offshoots of those. I mean, Fish sells out multiple nights at Madison Square Garden. They've never had a hit. That's what I'm talking about. And
you have a great Fish story, so I'd like to digress for a minute.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, so I was 10 years old, and I was on a... I come from a family of swim coaches. So we were in California at Senior Nationals, and my dad is a huge, huge music fan. So there was a big tour bus, and my dad was like, okay, cute little girl, like, go get autographs, you know? And I was shy, and I went up to them and got their autographs, and it was Fish. And they were hanging out and playing at the hotel pool. And I remember the athlete that we had at Senior Nationals was like, Fishbone? Who? I mean, this was 1992. And I said, no, Fish. And a few years later, he was so bummed he didn't say hi to them because they're obviously massive. That was the Fish story you're referring to, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, but, you know, it's not just jam bands. Dresden Dolls are the same way. I mean, technically, Coin Operated Boy got some airplay and things like that. And it was a hit in Australia. But other than that, you know, that's pretty weird, quirky music. And it was always all about the fans. So what I loved about working with Dresden Dolls and jam bands coming up is, you know, the music of each of those genres couldn't be more different, but it was the same mindset, you know, take care of the fans and the rest will take care of it itself.
Yeah, I just want to break this concept down to our listening audience. So success, I guess, in the music industry terms would be you're mentioning these singles and hits. So literally all of the setup and work up to an artist releasing an album, they have a few lead singles. They usually pick like two or three, right? That they think that, you know, they're going to put the label will put tons of money behind to promote and, you know, get out there and also pay radio to play. And those will be huge hits, Billboard hits that mm-hmm. brings the label back revenues. And hence the artist can then pay off all the money that they owe
right.
the label for all the promotion that was put into pushing these two or three songs that will hopefully help the label recoup their money.
Exactly.
Versus what happens now? What's success in this direct-to-fan realm?
Well, sure, but this might be tough for artists to hear, but I think success is making a living off making your music, you know, because it is so competitive. And then we just go from there. I mean, depending on what kind of artist it is, I have very clear financial goals for them. But yeah, I mean, if we're starting from scratch, if you do not have a day job, that's a very good start. And then I'm going to look at the strengths and the weaknesses. And
so hold on, let me clarify. Not having a day job is a good start, or getting a day job would be a good start?
If you're at the point where you don't have to work and you can just focus on music, okay. then you're successful as far as I'm concerned. And then will continue to grow and build off that. And hopefully you can be making music as your career for the rest of your life.
So how does your company get paid then in this model, or you yourself, for the work that you put in?
Managers work on commission, which is something I feel incredibly passionate about. I think that's one reason why managers are at the office past midnight and working on nights and weekends, for better or for worse. And, you know, just we're ultimately accountable for our artists. We only make money if they do. And when I launched Ready Made last year, the first two releases, I was able to convince the promo team to work on commission as well, because usually publicists and radio promo people, as you said, get a fee up front. And, you know, Brendan Benson had sunk a decent amount of money into his album. He can make music even cheaper now because he has his own studio. But, I couldn't really justify paying a publicist, paying a radio person, all these other people. And Brendan, who wrote the music, recorded the music, you know, sings on everything, plays on everything, getting paid last. I'm used to getting paid last. But what I love about that is I put so much thought into every decision I make. I'm not just throwing things at the wall to seeing what sticks, And I just wanted people to do the same. And so when we launched the label, we really did have high-level conference calls as a team. And I thought that people were finally thinking differently about promoting music instead of just doing with Brendan what they've done with him a million times before, or with other artists.
And what's wrong with doing what you've done a million times before?
Well, there's no consistency. So, you know, I'm always getting creative, trying to think about what makes sense and what works and what doesn't. But I've been through it too many times. Brendan Benson's been through it too many times. You know, it's what you referred to before. You set up the record and, you know, and then you go after these iTunes placements and maybe you get some press. And it's like, what does it mean? Like, if you're working on commission, I want people thinking about tangible results and what the return on investment is for that piece of press that they're getting, which is a tough thing to answer. But, you know, I had an intern at the time from the UK, and she had interned at a UK PR firm. And she said, my job as an intern was just to call 10 publications. And, you know, if they wrote about the artist, cool, if not, whatever. And she said, you're making the team put thought into why they're calling that publication.
And what's an average percentage for a manager? What's industry average?
15 to 20%, usually 15% of gross in the U.S. So 15% of gross or 20% of net. And we do consult from time to time. You know, that's an hourly or monthly thing. But what's been interesting about that, and this is like really shop talky, there's a band that I've consulted on for 4 years, and that came about because I knew how to do it, but I realized there weren't going to be commissions for a while. And you can look at my roster and figure out who this band is, because they've been around for a while. And my attorney said, you should consult, you know, because I said, I know exactly how to do this, but it's going to be 7 months of not getting paid, which is actually management. And what's been interesting about that, and we get paid hourly by these guys, and it's been a really long and wonderful relationship, is that had I commissioned on the deals and the work and the revenue that I've brought in over the past 4 years, it's about the same as what I've made working hourly or monthly. So it's just kind of...
So you're also making things work for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. But our biggest revenue streams is absolutely our management clients and our commissions. And I think when you're working on a percentage of revenue and income, you're going to work that much harder because you need to eat, you need to live.
How do you pick the people that you want to work with?
Artist-wise?
Yes.
We have three criteria. Talent, obviously I need to love what they do. Hard work, I don't want them working or caring more than we do. And they need to be a good person, because ultimately it's a partnership and you're working together. I don't work for the artists and they don't work for me. So, you know, you really need to have that trust, and those are the three things we look for.
You had a very poignant quote about caring. It was in the Medium article, and you were speaking about why an artist should care about their fans, but you also mentioned how an artist should treat their team. Do you remember?
I don't have to remember because I live it every,
every day,
you know? And I just, you know, I guess it's not just, but I started managing the Autumn Defense last year, which is Pat and John from Wilco, and they are two of the nicest musicians ever. And I inherited this whole fantastic team, and when we do conference calls, the first 10 minutes is a love fest about how great Pat and John are. And my assistant's like, every band I ever manage, can they please be like this? And it's a lot easier to get things done when they have such great reputations. But when you have a reputation for being a diva and canceling interviews and being difficult to work with, that's going to get around fast too, because we're people, you know, industry people are people too, and we want to have lives and go to yoga and relax and things like that. So, you know, and the thing is, like, if you're being difficult, and I know it's hard if an artist is being themselves and they don't realize if they're being difficult, but think about it. You know, if you're canceling things and you know, just not working very well with your team, that's time that we're spending rescheduling interviews and following up with you on things where we could be moving your career forward. So the more time you waste, the less time we have to work on your career. So I think that's something really important to keep in mind for the artist.
Yeah, you said something about energy specifically. You're saying that a harsh word can actually leave an imprint for a long time, and why waste the energy?
Definitely.
Damaging people or having someone hate you for 10 years when you can do the opposite and...
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's really how I live my life. But look, don't get me wrong. Like, your manager is your family member. They are your team member. I will say to artists sometimes, you can yell and scream all you want. Like, hopefully not at me, but in my direction if you need to vent or whatever. But, you know, if you get a really, I don't know if I can swear in here, so a really crappy email at the end of the day, and maybe I was going to power through and work a few more hours, at that point, I might just walk away from the computer and go to yoga and do something for myself. So, you know, I don't need the artist to be like motivating me the whole time, but that mutual respect and treating people well is going to go a long way.
We recently met. You were invited down as a guest for the show, and now you've joined the Metropolitan Ave team. So I just wanted to speak, let our listeners know what you'll be bringing them every other week, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm super excited. The first show is going to be November 19th. And I'm going to bring in my good friend and longtime colleague, Brianna Olson. Brie is a phenomenal music video director. So I'm just a fan of hers as an artist. But music video in and of itself is an interesting topic, because it's something that tons of money used to be spent on. And now everything's just going to end up on YouTube. So I need to be careful, because, you know, Brie's a really good friend of mine and I really respect her work. But ultimately, if I'm managing a band, it's hard for me to justify them spending a lot of money on a music video. Even though when I'm talking to Brie as a friend and a fan of her art, it's great when she has budgets, because she makes these phenomenal, you know, pieces of art. So, yeah, Brie and I met when we were about 20, working on the Dresden Dolls coin-operated boy video shoot. And, I mean, obviously, I'm kind of like a alpha type, a leader type of person. And I walked – and what I love about music video shoots is I'm not in charge. And I walked in on that video shoot, and Brie was about 20 years old, and I was like, I am listening to her. I mean, she just, you know, has it covered. So Brie will be – my first guest, and then my second show will be on December 10th, and I'll be bringing in Danny from The Big Sleep, who are a phenomenal New York band that I am lucky enough to manage. And Danny always knows the best holiday industry parties. Like, he goes to more than I do, and I joke with him about it, that he's great at networking, but he says, I just like free drinks and talking to people. So we will be previewing the best industry holiday parties to hit, and also covering some that he's gone to already, and talking about his band, of course, because they're a phenomenal Brooklyn band.
Great. And just to give an overview, the master plan is to really have Emily step up and fill in the industry segment portion, which again is educational. We hope to have podcasts up. People, musicians can hopefully refer to things and learn about how to actually conduct themselves in this changing music industry, and really just be smart and not get ripped off and know what percentage they should be paying their management and things like that. So we hope to have a wide array of people on the show, from management to licensing to sync. We've really covered that lately, but there's so much in that area. And Emily's really stepped up to really help out in that area. So we're very, very grateful for that. Yeah. So what's going on with you this week as we wrap up?
This week, I am headed to North Carolina tomorrow to visit Yep Rock Records with the Autumn Defense guys, and it's my birthday on Thursday, so I'm going to try to take Friday off.
It's like quite a few amazing people's birthday this week, so wow. Well, it's supposed to be bad luck to wish someone happy birthday ahead of time, so I'll just have to send you a text or call you on the day.
Thanks.
But that's awesome. Okay, that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest, Emily White of Whitesmith Entertainment and Ready Made Records. Emily, again, will be a regular feature on the show. Lila Salam, our videographer, and Joe for engineering today's show. You'll find tonight's broadcast of Metropolitan Ave and many other great shows archived on the heritageradionetwork.org website. You can also visit Heritage Radio Network on iTunes and Stitcher. See you next week, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.